Okay, so we can start with the next sutta, the next discourse by the Buddha. And this particular discourse I'm going to talk about now is basically about how to work with the mind, how to work with your thoughts, your perceptions, and how to actually learn how to change these things. How can we learn to think in a new way, to direct our whole set of mind in a way which is more aligned with the Dhamma, more aligned with wholesome qualities and away from the bad ones. So this is what this sutta is all about. And this, the reason why this is so important, and this is what I was talking about before, when you see the sequence of how meditation works, it is basically a natural sequence that happens by itself. And the initial thing which makes the whole sequence work, and one step leading to another one, is this idea of virtue in Buddhism. And the idea of virtue, the idea of morality, is very deep, and it includes also the way we think about things. And the most difficult one to actually do something about is our thoughts, right? We can maybe change our external behavior, even the way we speak, but actually changing the way we think is quite difficult because it's very ingrained and very deep-seated in us. So this sutta is basically about how to learn, how to think in a new way, how to direct our mind in a new direction. To me, it's incredibly useful, and it is one of the most important things to be able to do, to give the meditation an extra push to make it more powerful in the future. So this is all very practical, and it's practical in two particular ways. It is practical within the meditation itself. Sometimes you sit and you meditate, right, and some thought comes up that you don't really want to have. Some thought about some kind of pleasure somewhere, or maybe you get upset about something because it's something in the past. And you can use this particular method to overcome the bad or the negative thoughts in the meditation itself. But more importantly, you can use it throughout your life, throughout your daily life, to be able to alter your entire mindset, to change it around. So it has a kind of general application and also a specific application to the meditation itself. So in this way, it is very useful. So let's see what the Buddha has to say about this. This is one of these suttas, which is a biographical sutta. So the Buddha, or maybe I should say autobiographical, that's the Buddha talking about his own life and talking about his own experience. And one of the things about these suttas where the Buddha talks about his own life, it's important to understand why the Buddha does this. Sometimes, I don't think it's such a problem in the West, but in many traditional Buddhist countries, they tend to elevate the Buddha too high. And when you elevate the Buddha too high, he becomes like a god, right? Something which is unreachable by human beings, something beyond our experience. Something you pray to get your nice new car or something like that. And this is actually what happens sometimes. And then you have kind of lost contact with what the Buddha really is about. And the idea that the Buddha is a human being is just very important to grasp. He's just a human being just like us. The only difference is that he has taken the human potential to its absolute maximum. That is the difference, because he's still human. And when you know that the Buddha is human, then of course his life story has a purpose, right? We can do the same thing that the Buddha did. When the Buddha tells his life story, tells about how he practiced, it's not just a theoretical thing that we're supposed to worship, but it's actually an example for us for how to practice. So once you see the Buddha as a human being just like us, it means that the Buddha's life becomes an example to us, and we should follow in his footsteps. And this is what the Buddha does, and it's quite a large number of discourses that are autobiographical in this way. And I would recommend you to read those suttas. They're very beautiful, very powerful. And read them as examples of how we too should exert ourselves and practice in our own life. And then they become very powerful. They become very powerful because you get an idea of who the Buddha is, but also powerful as a guide to practice. So this is how this sutta goes. It's called Two Kinds of Thoughts. This is the standard opening of the sutta. It goes like this. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove and at Apindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, monks in other words. Venerable Sir, they replied, and the Blessed One, the Buddha, in other words, he said this. So this is the standard opening of the sutta. I'll just give you a little bit of information about that, because for those of you who are not used to this, it may seem a bit strange. Thus have I heard. What that means is that we are dealing with an oral tradition. The suttas were passed down orally at the very beginning. There was no writing at the time of the Buddha. So it was passed from one generation of monks to the next one verbally, right? So you had to memorize these things. And that's why it starts off with, thus have I heard. You have heard these suttas from a previous generation. It gets passed down. And this is why you have, thus have I heard at the beginning here. And so usually the suttas, they start with that particular phrase. And then the Blessed One was living at Sarvati. Sarvati was one of the big cities in India at that time. It was in the kingdom called Kosala, which was one of the largest cities, countries in India at the time of the Buddha. So very powerful. And that in that Sarvati, they had, as in many of the large cities, they had like places just outside the city, parks or forest groves where the monks and nuns would normally live. And one of these forest groves was known as Jeta's Grove. Jeta was a prince, and he had donated this grove to for the purpose of the monastic Sangha, to use that as a place for living. So there was a large monastery out there. And at the Pindika's Park, and at the Pindika was a merchant who had bought this grove from Prince Jeta and then given it to the Sangha, monastic Sangha afterwards. And this Jeta's Grove, it still exists to the present day. This is one of the amazing things. If you ever want to go, if you ever have a feeling about you would like to go to India to see the sights of Buddhism, I would recommend it's very powerful. Anybody here been to India before? Yeah. Yes? Quite a few of you. Okay, that's wonderful. Did you go to the Buddhist sites as well? Or? Yes? Okay. And it's very powerful, because one of the things that you find out when you go to India, you find out that these texts, they are not, I mean, these are ancient texts, right? Go back 2,500 years. And then you go there, and you can actually see these sites to the present day. These sites have been excavated by archaeologists, and you actually find these things right there, right there. And when you see them, it's kind of an eye-opener. This is real. It's not kind of just a theoretical thing you find in these texts. They actually exist, these things. And many of the things that you find in the discourses of the Buddha are still the same today in India. You know, it says, one example that I always like to mention is this example of when you go to Varanasi, to Benares, which is a big city in the middle of the river Ganges. It's a very holy city, according to the Hindus. But it was also one of the four main places of Buddhist pilgrimage. And when you, this is where the place where the Buddha gave his first discourse. And when you go there in the present day, you know, straight away, the Indians, they're very, when they see a foreigner, they grab hold of you straight away, and they want to sell you all kinds of things. And the thing they want to sell you in Varanasi is cloth, right? To this present day, Varanasi is the cloth capital of India. They've got very beautiful cloth, beautiful patterns, beautiful colors, high quality things. So they grab you and they want to sell you cloth. And then you read the suttas, and in the suttas it's exactly the same thing. It says that, you know, the cloth from Varanasi, that was the good cloth at the time of the Buddha. And these are the things that you see, you know, or the description of the nature, description of the, you know, the hills and these kind of things are still the same in the suttas as you find when you go there in the present day. And you know that you are now in the presence of these suttas when you travel around northern India. It's a very powerful experience. I'm going to India again in January. I'm going to lead a tour in India in January again, and I'm looking forward to that. I haven't been there for a few years, because I know that it's quite a powerful experience to do these things. Anyway, I better move on a little bit, otherwise we're going to be here for a very, very long time. So, this is what the Buddha said. Bhikkhus, monks, before my awakening, I prefer awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty or harming or ruthlessness. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation or non-desire, thoughts of non-ill will, or perhaps thoughts of metta, and thoughts of non-ruthlessness, in other words, thoughts of compassion perhaps. And then Yeah, so let's just stop there for a second. So this is the Buddha before his awakening, right? Before he attains his understanding of the world. So the Buddha is saying specifically, this is what I did to attain my own awakening experience. We have the idea here of the unenlightened or unawakened bodhisattva, and this is the only way that the word bodhisattva or bodhisattva, if you like, is used in the suttas. It's used, the Buddha uses that of his very last life before he achieves awakening, right? The years from he's born, basically, or even better, the time from when he decides to renounce the household life until he reaches awakening. That is the period when the Buddha uses, when he was a bodhisattva. The idea that the time of being a bodhisattva expands kind of limitless time into the past is a much later idea in Buddhism that came maybe a few hundred years after the Buddha. It started to evolve quite soon after the Buddha, but it evolved for a long time after that. So the bodhisattva is the Buddha after he starts his search in this particular life. And actually quite interesting, what does the word bodhisattva actually mean? This is actually quite interesting, because very often the way this word is translated or understood is bodhi. Bodhi means awakening. And sattva in Sanskrit language means being. So it means like awakening being, which is a rather strange word, awakening being. What exactly does that mean? Some people, linguists, have pointed out that actually there's another way to understand this word, which I think perhaps is just as likely, or perhaps even more likely than bodhisattva, and that is the Sanskrit word bodhisakta. And bodhisakta means, sakta means to be intent on, right? Somebody who is aspiring for or desiring, somebody who is intent on awakening, is another understanding of bodhisatta. And that to me is the most likely explanation for the meaning of this word. Instead of awakening being, it means someone who is intent on awakening. In other words, he renounces the household life because he wants to find out something, right? So he's intent on that awakening. That is my understanding. And this is an understanding that was first suggested by a man called Professor Richard Gombrich, who's a professor of Sanskrit at Oxford University. Because you have to know your language pretty well to come up with these alternative explanations. And I don't really know Sanskrit well enough to be able to see such things myself. Anyway, so that was the what he did. And then what he did, the first thing he does here, you will see, he divides his thinking into two classes. Sensual thoughts on one side, and all these negative thoughts of cruelty, and then the good thoughts on the other side. This is obviously important, right? If you want to cultivate your mind, you want to move towards something positive away from the negative, you have to divide these things. You have to know that there is such a thing as bad thoughts and there is such a thing as good thoughts. Only when you know that can you actually do something about it. So this must be the first thing that you do. So he understood at least that much, that there is good thinking and there is bad thinking. And of course that is also important for us, right? Many people will not recognize this. They will not understand that anger usually has negative consequences. To understand that sensual thoughts are negative is even more difficult. The majority of people think that sensuality is just good fun and that there's no danger with sensuality. But the Buddha realized that there actually is a danger there in the sensual world. And this is what we're going to look at as we go through this. And then he says, and this is quite interesting, he says that as I abided thus, diligent, ardent and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. So diligent, ardent and resolute, this just means that you are energetic, right? You're trying your best, you're being heedful, you're being careful in your practice. That's what that basically means. You're applying yourself to try to change. So the meaning here of applying yourself and being energetic is that you divide the thinking into two parts. That's what it means. Right? It doesn't mean that you strive very hard. It doesn't mean that you push yourself. It doesn't mean that you have lots of desires and all these kind of things. All it means is that you divide your thinking into two parts. In other words, you are wise. You understand the world. You understand what is good and bad. It is an aspect of wisdom to be ardent, diligent and resolute. Right? I'm sure you can see that. When you read this now, you can see that that's the case. As I abided thus, in other words, referring back to what he's just been saying. And this shows you that what I was talking about yesterday. Yesterday I didn't have any examples of it, but it shows you that in Buddhism, the idea of applying yourself, of being energetic, of being heedful and careful in your practice, is about wisdom, basically. That's what it shows you. It's about how you look at the world, understanding the world in the right way. That's what it really is all about. It's not so much about, you know, gritting your teeth and clenching your fists or whatever. It's about wisdom practice. And this is what this shows you here. And it becomes even more clear further down as we go down this page. So he, as he abided in this way, a thought of sensual desire, right? Some kind of desire arises in you. You think, oh, it would be nice to do this or nice to do that. And then he says, I understood thus, a thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. I'll just read this paragraph out first of all. A thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, in other words, my own pain, right, or suffering, to others' affliction, to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, it causes difficulties, and it leads away from Nibbana. When I considered, this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered, this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered, this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered, this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So the first thing here is that he says that I understood thus, a thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. Now, maybe that seems obvious to you, but it's not as obvious as you might think, because the point here is that sensual desire is a very broad field of things. From the coarsest kind of sensual desire, when you desire something very coarse, right? To the most refined things. The most refined things is almost like when you're sitting on your meditation cushion and you want to scratch something because something is itching, or you want to move because something is painful. That also is in the realm of the senses. It's a very, very broad thing. And what the Buddha is saying here is that I understood the whole range, right? Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose, I understood that. And this is part of the difficulty of understanding these things, actually understanding this whole range. And when you read things like the Satipatthana Sutta, you will know that the very last part, called the Dhammanupassana of the Satipatthana Sutta, is about understanding this kind of thing. It says, I understood sensual desire. I understood the cause for the sensual desire. I understood how it is abandoned. And I understood how the non-arising of sensual desire happens in the future. This is directly quoting from the Satipatthana Sutta. So this is very similar to what is happening in the Satipatthana Sutta. The understanding of these defilements, understanding why they're there, etc. So this is the first thing, and this is difficult enough. And what you have to do here, this is what we were talking about yesterday, about this idea of the gradual training where you start with the coarse defilements and you move towards the more refined ones. So you get to know yourself. You get to know what the coarsest defilements are first of all. And you start with abandoning that. Then you move on. And when the coarser defilements are abandoned, what happens is your mind becomes more clear. You get more mindfulness. Because you have more mindfulness, you uncover more defilements, right? It's a bit terrible, isn't it? You kind of throw something away and there's more coming up afterwards. It's kind of... But this is the way it is. And you find some more defilements in there. These are like the middling defilements. Then you work on those. And mind becomes even more clear. Your mindfulness improves. And we'll talk about this afterwards. A very direct relationship between mindfulness and defilements. The less defilements you have, the more mindful you are. And it's very obvious why that must be the case. But maybe we can talk about that afterwards. So you throw up those, and then it comes even more defilements. Oh no, I thought I was becoming purified. But actually it doesn't matter so much, because what you find is that with every time you chuck out some defilements, you actually feel much better about yourself. You feel more peaceful. You feel more good. You feel more joy coming into your life every time you throw something out. So it doesn't really matter so much whether there's more defilements there, because you gain so much every time you abandon something. And this is of course part and parcel of the benefits of this path. So you know these sensual desires, you uncover them gradually, stage by stage, as you do this practice. So how then, how do we deal with this? And this is how the Buddha deals with these things, right? He says here that once the sensual desire arose, he thinks that this leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. The word affliction just means suffering, right? It means pain, it means problems. So it leads to my own affliction. So why is it? How come sensual desires leads to your affliction? What is the reason for that? And most people think, as I said before, sensual desires are just a bit of fun. You know, you have a bit of fun in the world. And obviously it is true that there is some gratification or some happiness in sensual pleasures. If there wasn't, people wouldn't be indulging in sensual pleasures, you know. When I get my food for the meal upstairs, I get a nice breakfast given to me at the hotel where I'm staying here, then, you know, I too enjoy that food. I don't sort of think of the food with aversion. This is, you know, this is just natural that we enjoy the sensual pleasures of the world. So how do we understand that there is a problem here? And this is quite hard. It's quite difficult because we are so immersed in this world. But it's very useful to incline your mind at least a little bit to understanding why this is difficult, why this can be problematic. And I will give you some examples. One of the examples, one of the reasons why it is problematic is that every time you desire something, it means that you also want to acquire that object, right? And so all the things that we acquire during our life, our house, our flat, our car, our clothes, our relationships, all of these things are acquired as a consequence of sensual desires, thoughts of sensual desires. And once you acquire them basically to gratify the sensual desires. You have a house. Your house is like your place to be, right? Your haven, your safe haven from the world, where you enjoy yourself, where you have a bit of entertainment, where you have your meals, and you kind of shut the world a bit out. And this is your place. That's where you have your family. And that, you know, it's a place that you enjoy. So what happens when you enjoy something like that? What happens is that you're attached to it, right? If somebody... So craving always, desire, sensual thoughts always lead to attachment. You get the things, you take them up. This is called upadana in Pali. This is all about dependent arising here. Craving leads to upadana. Upadana is like attachment or holding on to things. So it must be that way here. And then once you're attached to something here, once something becomes important to you because it becomes a source of pleasure and happiness, then it becomes hard to give up again. If somebody takes it from you, it's painful, right? If your house burns down with all your possessions, you kind of despair because everything you have built up over a long period of time gets destroyed. If your relationship with somebody you're very close to gets destroyed because they have an affair with somebody else or because they die or because they, whatever it is, if it's a good relationship, it's very painful again. And this is the reason why sensual pleasures in the world are problematic, because whenever there is a thought of sensuality, attachment is just behind there. And once you attach, you are opening yourself up for suffering here. Attachment will always lead to suffering in life. And this is part of the problem. So this is one way of understanding why sensuality is problematic. Yeah, there are other ways, but I think that is probably one of the most powerful ones. And one of the things that you find is that as your meditation improves and you're moving on this path, you're starting to release those attachments a little bit because you start to find happiness in other things. You find happiness in peace, happiness in compassion, happiness in having a good heart. And when you find happiness there, it means that your attachment to the sensual world becomes less. And the more you kind of lift your mind up in this way, the less attachments you have to sensuality, and the less the sensual things in the world hold you back, so to speak. That's great, because it means you become more independent, right? You don't feel that the sensual world has so much of a hold on you anymore. You are independent, your happiness comes from inside. You're freeing yourself from the world. And this is the power of this path, the sense of inner freedom, independence of everything else.
And then when your partner leaves you, it's still a little bit painful, but it's much less painful than it would have been if you hadn't developed your mind in meditation, in virtue, and all these other things. Okay, but not only, so this is how, a little bit about how it leads to your own affliction. It also leads to the affliction of others. Right? So your sensual desires lead to the problem for other people as well. So why is it that your sensuality, your sensual pleasures or your sensual desires lead to problems for others? How can that be? And there's a very nice simile in the suttas where the Buddha has, actually one of the suttas I really like, it has lots of similes about the problems of sensual pleasures. And the Buddha says that it's just like a bird which catches a piece of meat and then it flies away. And as soon as it flies away with this piece of meat in its mouth, other birds come, they start attacking it because they want this piece of meat as well, right? This is what the world is like. We're fighting over things. And this is true also in the human realm. Humans also, we are fighting over things in life. When you're a child, you are, you know, there's only so many sweets to go around and, you know, everybody wants the sweets, or you want to play with the same toy or whatever it is. And when you become older, you know, you fight over the same girlfriend or the same boyfriend, right? Everybody wants the same person because they think this person is nice and attractive or whatever. Or you fight over the same job, you fight over the same promotion, you fight over getting that, you know, this extra salary. Or we go on the market, everybody wants the nice house, but but only some people can have it. There's always this sense of competition. We're competing with each other in so many spheres of life. And that competition means that some people get it and some people don't, right? And this competition often leads to conflict, leads to problems. A lot of the arguments in the world, a lot of the interpersonal problems we have are based on sensuality, because of these kind of things. If you analyze it deeply enough, it is often based on sensuality. If you had no sensual preferences and no sensual desires, the vast majority of arguments in the world and problems we have with each other would disappear. And this is so this is one of the reasons why when you have sensual desire, when you attach to things, you end up in conflict with other people. And that conflict with other people is why it also leads to the affliction of others as well. So not only, so these are just some simple way. These are the things that these are explained in the suttas. Basically, I always try to base myself on the suttas. Some simple ways of understanding this. And then you have, it also leads to the affliction of both, right? And the reason, the point here is that sometimes we think that I will be the martyr. You know, it leads to pain for me, but it's good for somebody else. But no, it doesn't work. The sensual pleasure is a problem for both yourself and for the other person. So there's no martyrdom as possible. And greed doesn't work either, because you think, I will get it, but no, but somebody else will suffer. I don't care about the other people. That doesn't work either, because it leads to your problem as well. Okay, so these things are quite hard to understand. And I, you know, it has taken me a long time, even as a monk, to really get a grip on these things, because they actually are quite profound. So I would recommend you, if you find that this is alien, and I'm sure some of you probably find it quite hard to understand these things, just think about them, allow them to sink in and see if it makes sense. And as you think about these things, you will either come to accept it, to see there's some truth there, or perhaps you will reject it. But either way, it is good to reflect on them. Okay, so then the next one he says, it obstructs wisdom. When you have a sense of sensual pleasure, you lose your wisdom, right? The Pali word is panya nirodhika. Your group is called nirodha, right? Nirodha, which means cessation, the ending of things. So panya is wisdom in Pali. So it makes wisdom cease. That's what it means. So it is the sensual pleasures causes the ending of wisdom. That's pretty bad news, isn't it? I mean, when I think about wisdom, for me, wisdom is like the highest thing that anybody could aspire for. Wisdom is understanding how things work, understanding suffering and happiness in life. It's about, you know, being able to deal with the world, deal with other people in a wise way. Wisdom is the highest kind of spiritual faculty. In fact, when you read the suttas, wisdom is always on top. And when you have wisdom, the other spiritual faculties, they stabilize. You know, the samadhi, the mindfulness, all of these things stabilize as a consequence of wisdom. So wisdom is the highest faculty we can have on the spiritual path. And sensual pleasure makes it cease. So that must be very bad news. So why is that? And just to give you some example of why that is. And the most obvious example that you can find, I think, is you know, when people have are unfaithful to each other. They have a relationship with someone other than their boyfriend or girlfriend, or whoever they're married to. So why do these things happen? And the reason why they happen is because at the time, it just seems like such a good idea, right? The opportunity comes up, and because of desire, because of that attraction which is there, you actually have this extra, you become unfaithful to your partner. And then afterwards, after you have done this, most of the time you regret it so badly afterwards, because it means the end of your marriage, it means the end of your relationship with somebody you probably actually like much more than the person you had a relationship to anyway. It means that you only get to see your kids every other week or whatever it is. It means that you have to sell your house. It means enormous complications in your life and the destruction of all the goodness that you had. So why does this happen then? And the reason why it happens, why is it that beforehand it seems like a very good idea, you can't waste this opportunity to have this relationship, and afterward it seems like a terrible thing which destroys your life? Why that difference? And the reason is because when the desire is there, you're blind. Wisdom ceases. There's no wisdom anymore. You can't see what is right and what is wrong. Desire distorts your mind. It's the desire itself that distorts your mind. And basically, you're incapable of seeing difference between right and wrong. What will lead to happiness in the long run, and what will lead to suffering in the long run. So this is how it works. This is how desire distorts your mind. Or very simply, you just, you know, you sometimes go out shopping and you see something in the window which looks nice, and you kind of do a kind of spur of the moment, shop something, and afterwards you wonder, why on earth did I buy that? It's a similar kind of thing. It's the desire which distorts your mind in a very simple way. And what this means is that whenever you see desire in your mind, you know that the wisdom is reduced, right? So if you want to make a decision in life, this is one of the things that come out of this, which I often recommend people to be very careful. If you're going to make a decision in life, never make a decision when your mind is obsessed by desire, when your mind is obsessed by any other defilements, by anger, by cruelty, by confusion. That is always the wrong time to make a decision. If you're going to make a decision, make the decision when your mind is clear. When the mind is peaceful, there's no craving, there's no anger, there's no confusion there. That is when you can see clearly. You might still not have 100% wisdom, but at least you have a little bit, you have much more wisdom at least than you have when you are real, when the desires are very strong. So this is the problem. And remember this, desire distorts the mind. And this is one of the things that you find throughout the suttas, is how distorted things actually get. And this is why you want to reduce the desire gradually. Like I said yesterday, you purify yourself gradually. Less and less desire, less and less sensual pleasures. And as you do that, the clarity, with every step, the clarity improves. And every step, you become more clear. Every step, the vipassana becomes more powerful. Vipassana just means seeing things clearly. So the vipassana improves for every step of abandoning the defilements. And when the defilements are completely gone, only then is the mind 100% undistorted. So only then is it possible to have real vipassana, real clarity, and actually see things as they really are. So this is the path then. You can see there's two kind of aspects to the Buddhist path. One is the abandoning of these bad states of mind. And you use your best of your ability to abandon these things initially. Any kind of clarity of mind you have in the beginning, any kind of vipassana that you do before the hindrances or the defilements are abandoned, that vipassana, its purpose is just to abandon the defilements, nothing more. This is the purpose of it. And then after the hindrances are completely gone, that is when the purpose of vipassana changes from the purpose being to abandon the defilement. Now the purpose is to see things according to reality. In other words, the thing is impermanent suffering and non-self, the profound realities that we talk about in Buddhism. So So this is a rough way of understanding the Buddhist path. Does that make sense to everybody? Am I being reasonably clear? Yeah. Because sometimes it's hard to know what you say things. You think it's clear, but then people really scratch their head afterwards. What on earth is he talking about? So. Okay. Okay, so that is how it distorts the mind, right? The desire distorts the mind. So it obstructs wisdom. And just that thought is kind of horrifying. Now I know that I can't see clearly. And that kind of scares you a little bit. You know that you're going to make mistakes when you are obsessed by these defilements of the mind. So it obstructs wisdom. It causes difficulties. It basically means that it is on the side of problems. It's problematic. When you have desires in your mind, that very reality of craving, the very reality of desire, is actually a painful feeling. I would recommend you look at your mind. Sometimes the reason why we can't see the pain of craving is because we're focusing on the object, and the object seems very beautiful when you crave. But instead of focusing on the object, feel the craving instead. Ask yourself, what does this feel like? It's a kind of, you reverse the thing. Instead of looking outside at the object, you look at what it feels like. And what it feels like is like a burning experience, right? The Buddha always compares craving to fire. It is a fire inside the mind. It's a burning experience. It's painful. It's hot. And the reason you can't see it is because you're focusing in the wrong place. You're looking at the object instead of the feeling. And compare that craving to a time when you feel very peaceful. And see the difference. And when you see the difference, you will start to understand why craving and sensual desires are a problem. One of the problems with the world of sensual pleasures and sensuality is that it is always conjoined with craving. There's no such thing as having sensual pleasures or there being sensual pleasures and not having craving. This always goes together. Most of the world of sensual pleasures is always about running after them, trying to get them. You can't really distinguish between those two things. And then the last one is it leads away from Nibbana. Nibbana in Buddhism just means peace, right? The actual meaning of the word Nibbana is something like extinguishment. You're extinguishing the flame, right? So it means to extinguish or to put out the fire. That's what Nibbana means. And you can see very simply that it leads away from Nibbana, because when you have the desire, it's like you're on fire, right? It's not a peaceful state, it's the opposite. It's craving, it's restless, it's you feel agitated when you crave. It's the opposite of being peaceful. And this is the leading away from what Nibbana is all about. So, and then of course what the Buddha does here, all he has to do, he says here, he has to reflect that this leads to my own affliction. And by doing that, it disappears, right? It goes straight away. I have to reflect that it destroys wisdom. Just by that thought, it goes away straight away. So how is that possible? How can the thought just go away by understanding this? And the reason is because you understand it to a very deep degree. You really understand that this leads to suffering. And this is why with so many things in Buddhism, you actually have to reflect on these things again and again and again, to internalize it, to really understand it in a deep way. And when you do that, they become very powerful. Right? This is the point here. They become so powerful that all you have to do is remember that these things are painful. These things are suffering. And straight away, the mind goes away. And this is the metaphor I was using yesterday, the simile of the, when you put your hand on the hot plate. When you put your hand on the hot plate, the reaction is automatic. I mean by accident. We put it by accident. You pull it back automatically because you don't even have to think it's suffering. You know it's suffering. And it's exactly the same thing. When you internalize the problem here and you really know that there's a problem, the mind automatically recoils and recoils away from that. And that is why it's so powerful, right? This is what we mean. This is part of what we mean by understanding things according to reality. Your mind turns away by itself. It's a very powerful tool. For many of us, it takes a lot of practice to get to that point, but at least it works a little bit. If you understand a little bit more, you turn away a little bit more. So, and gradually, you come to that point. So this is a natural process. This is not something that you force. You don't tell yourself that this is bad, I can't do this, that is the wrong way of doing it. It's a natural thing. You try to understand. If it doesn't work, that's fine. But you try to understand. And when you understand, it will have an effect, right? And that is what we mean. You don't mean that you force yourself to go away from sensual pleasures. What we mean is you reflect on it. And if the reflection works, it is a natural consequence that you move away. Often people think that when they do this kind of practice, they get really worried because they think that all the happiness in the world is going to disappear, everything is going to go away, life is going to be so meaningless. But the point is, it's natural. And because it's natural, there's no problem there, right? You find your happiness somewhere else. There actually is no problem whatsoever. In fact, it's a positive feeling. If it feels negative, then it means that you haven't really understood what's going on. Okay. So this is what the Buddha did. And then the thought of sensual desire subsided in him because of that. And then he says, whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it, right? Now these words here, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it, is very similar to what I was, the Pali behind this is very similar to the words I was talking about yesterday, where I talked about the earnest, capable bhikkhu monk who abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates those thoughts. The Pali words are the same, it's just different translators, so you get different words in English. And this is the problem with reading it in English, you can't really see properly the connections all the time. But because I know the Pali behind, I can tell you that it is the same words. This is how you abandon these things, right? Now you understand what abandoning and obliterating and removing these things actually mean. What they mean is that you use the wisdom power to abandon these things. That's what it means. You can see here, there's nothing here about willpower, right? It's all about thinking in the right way. And when you think in the right way, they get abandoned. So this is what I was saying yesterday, that the path of Buddhism, the path of understanding things in the right way, is about wisdom, it's about understanding, it's about applying your mind in the right way. And when you do that, then these things happen as a natural consequence. So no force is really required. No power is required. It's the wisdom that is the main requirement here. And that is it's a beautiful thing, because using force all the time is painful. If you have to force yourself to do things, there's a degree of pain always, you know, together with force. But wisdom, there's very little pain. There's a little bit of pain in trying to kind of understand things, applying your mind. Of course, always when you apply yourself, there's a tiny amount of effort that you have to use just to apply yourself. But it's a very small amount, and it becomes a very easy path when the majority of what you use is wisdom rather than willpower. So wisdom power rather than willpower is the way to go. This is how the Buddha himself explains that. And my teacher, Ajahn Brahm, he always makes thought out of willpower, but it doesn't really come from him. It comes from the Buddha himself, the idea of using wisdom rather than will. And this is important. Very often you will learn about Buddhism, and you want to be, you know, you're told about sense restraint and all these kind of things. But how do you do sense restraint? Very often you won't hear anything about that. You won't be told in detail how you restrain your senses. But here it is. The way you restrain your senses is by wisdom, by being wise about these things. And then it happens naturally. So, there you are. So now let us go on to the other defilements. This is, I've just been looking at sensuality. And one of the things that I would like you to keep in mind is that for much more important than overcoming sensuality is to overcome the anger and the ill will. Anger and ill will is a much more serious and much more negative defilement than sensuality. So first of all, put your effort into overcoming anger and ill will, and then sensuality is something which can come later on, or maybe comes a little bit on the side, so to speak. But this is the one that really matters, because anger and ill will is very destructive, right? Both for yourself and also for the people around you. So again, the setup here is exactly the same. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of ill will, in other words, a thought which has ill will in it, right, arose in me. a thought of ruthlessness arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of ruthlessness has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, it leads away from nibbana. When I consider thus, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of ruthlessness or cruelty arose in me, I abandoned it, did away with it, and removed it. So, the fact that anger is problematic, I think, is very much more obvious than sensual pleasures, but it is still worth remembering how much problems anger can lead to in life, how it can estrange us from other people, how it can make, you know, friendships sour and get destroyed, how it makes our own life miserable. If you're angry all the time, you just feel miserable inside, right? It's a terrible feeling. Some people are always a bit angry, always a bit irritated, and it's a terrible feeling to have this inside of you all the time. It makes your life miserable, causes all kinds of problems for yourself and others. And just as with sensuality, when you are angry, when you feel that your anger is righteous, right? I am right about this. This is good to be angry in this case because I know what's going on. And because of that anger, you will say things and do things that otherwise you would not do. You think that this person deserves to hear this, right? They have been stupid, and it would be good for them that I tell them so that they can learn something about this situation. And then in anger, you tell them something because of that anger. And of course, it doesn't usually work, right? If you are angry, people aren't going to listen to you. People are going to dismiss you as an angry, grumpy old whatever. And they're not going to listen to you. They get defensive. They say, I'm not going to listen to somebody who's angry. And it's fair enough. We probably shouldn't listen too much to people who are angry, because usually they don't really understand the situation as it is. And then you do something in your angry state. You know, you slap your child or something like that. I know that in the Nordic countries, we people try to avoid these things. It's actually punishable by law, isn't it? Is that in Finland as well? Punishable by law, yeah. That's the way it is in Norway now. It has been for a long, long time already. But sometimes you do these crazy things when you get angry, and afterwards you think, wow, when you feel balanced again, when you feel kind of back to your senses again, you realize you made a mistake. And it's exactly the same thing with sensual pleasures. When you are angry, when you are obsessed by anger, you can't see clearly. Your wisdom has ceased again, just like before. Because your wisdom has ceased, you don't know what's going on, and you do things that you regret later on. So anger, again, destroys your wisdom, destroys your ability to see things clearly. And think about that, reflect about that in your own life. And I think you will be able to see why that is the case and how that is the case. It's not that hard to, not that difficult to see, especially with anger. Causes difficulties, right? It's problematic, it's painful to be angry. Again, what you have to do there, again, you have to turn your attention away from the object of the anger. Once you see the object, you can't see that anger is painful because you're just justifying it by looking at the object. Feel it instead. And once you start to feel it, you see that it is a problem. It is painful. It is something not nice. It leads away from nibbana, etc. So, I'm not going to say much more about anger. So, you again, reflect, please reflect on these things and see if you can make them become more meaningful for you. Then the Buddha says, that whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will or of ruthlessness, he has abandoned the thought of metta, of non-cruelty, non-ruthlessness, of compassion, to cultivate the thought of cruelty. And then his mind inclines towards cruelty. Every time you have a thought of sensual pleasures, you're strengthening that pathway. You're becoming more inclined to that. Every time you think a thought of metta, you think a thought of compassion, or renunciation, as it says here, you're strengthening that particular pathway, and it's more likely that you will think about that in the future. And this is one reason why we do the metta meditation, right? Because you're strengthening that aspect of the mind. When you strengthen that, it is more likely that that will happen again also in the future. And eventually, the idea here is that eventually, if you keep on practicing like this, there comes a time when you can't help yourself thinking kind thoughts, right? You just sit down and you automatically think kind thoughts about people. Of course, sometimes you still think bad thoughts. It's not always like that. But your general habit becomes one of thinking kind thoughts. And this is what I said on the first day and Friday night, the simile of the mountain. The simile of the mountain, of this person who does all kind of good things in their life, who thinks kind thoughts, who speaks the right things and does the right things. When that person in the evening, when they sit down and they close their eyes, they just feel happiness, they feel a natural sense of ease, a natural sense of well-being, because the mind inclines in that direction, inclines towards all these good things, and all these good things come back to you, right? Then it becomes easy, and this is when meditation becomes possible. Then when you meditate, your mind is in the right state. The mind is in a place where the attitude is correct. I talked about attitude, this is all about attitude here. Your inclination and attitude are the same thing, basically. Your attitude is right, and meditation happens by itself. So this is why the Buddhist path is often, it becomes easier as you practice, as you go along. It becomes easier and easier because these things become natural consequences. So the last thing I'm going to do before I stop for now is just to read out the simile here. And the simile is as follows. Just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged. Flogged is like whipped, right? Imprisoned, fined and blamed if he let them stray into the crops. So too I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So it's like the cowherd, right? When the cowherd knows that if he lets the cows go into the field, they will eat all the crops, and the farmer will get very angry with him and maybe get him thrown into jail or whatever because he hasn't been doing his job. So he has to be vigilant, he has to be on guard. And now you know what it means to be vigilant. To be vigilant means just to be aware of what's happening inside of you. To understand whether your mind has a defiled thought or not. Whether you have desire. Whether you are angry. This is what it means to be vigilant. And then it means to apply wisdom. When something goes wrong, to apply wisdom in the right way. To allow those defilements to drop down and disappear. Just as this cowherd taps and pokes his cows with a stick to ensure that they don't go in the wrong way. So you tap and poke your mind. You don't do tap and poke it so much, you use the wisdom faculty to make it move in the right direction. Okay, that is about an hour or so already. I think I better stop there, otherwise it's too much for me, too much for you, probably too much for everyone. And then we can continue. The rest of the sutta is fairly repetitive, so it's quite quick. Then we can move on to the last sutta at the after the meal at 1 o'clock or something. So now please enjoy your meditation, chill out, and have a good time.